Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board today, Jim McCormick, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
Megan Goldberg with us as well, Assistant Professor of American Politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Hi there, Megan.
Hi, Ben.
We invite our listeners to join us as we do every Politics Wednesday. You should have these numbers, this email noted somewhere, perhaps on your refrigerator, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Later in the program, we'll talk about how the Iowa governor, Governor Reynolds, signed a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Talk about the implications of that. Also, what might the abortion rulings in Florida mean for the general election? We heard President Biden met with the Chinese president yesterday. So much outrage over after the killing of the aid workers in Gaza, and a plan, Speaker Johnson, perhaps for U.S. aid for Ukraine that's been blocked in our Congress. But first, let's talk about what happened 15 years ago today, April 3rd, 2009. Iowa became the third state, the very first here in the Midwest, to establish marriage equality. The Iowa Supreme Court ruled same-sex marriage legal in the case of Varnum v. Breen. It was a unanimous decision. However, it would cost three of those justices their seats when they were up for a retention vote in 2010. April 3rd, 2009, a historic victory for the state's gay and lesbian couples, a sign of hope for others across the nation who had long awaited for the day their union would be recognized in the eyes of the law. Camilla Taylor is deputy legal director for the for litigation at Lambda Legal, served as counsel for the plaintiffs in the Varnum v. Breen case. I spoke with her 5 years ago as we marked the 10th anniversary of the unanimous Iowa Supreme Court decision. She said then she believes the court victory in the Midwest was pivotal to the expansion of marriage rights across the country.
I absolutely do. I mean, I think that there were millions of micro acts of bravery of people coming out and demanding respect for themselves and for their families. And having a government say that you enjoy equal rights, you have the freedom to marry just like any other family, and you should have that respect, was very important in helping to prompt those acts of bravery. But once people have come out and once they've demanded that respect for themselves, I don't think the world can ever change back.
Join us with your reflections on this day, 15 years ago, when Iowa became the third state to legalize marriage equality. Also, what's the climate for LGBTQ Iowans today? Weigh in on that. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Now, I believe, Jim, you were in the state for that, at the epicenter of this decision. Megan, I believe you were not. Megan, may I start with you? I don't know where you were on April 3rd, 2009. How do you remember that historic day?
Yeah, you know, so I was, do you want me to say where I was? I was in college, but in a different Midwestern state that also starts with an I. That notably was not taking these sort of progressive strides at the time. And, you know, I think that thinking about the significance of this in the Midwest, you know, just in a couple states over, you know, I had at the time in college faculty members who were out and partnered, but leaving the state because they couldn't get, you know, through their employer, they couldn't get healthcare coverage for their partners. And if their partners were sick, and then, you know, having children was a whole other complicated matter. And I just think about the ways that those lives have been changed, you know, sort of by this decision and then what led to, you know, later a federal decision, that I think, you know, the political implications of a court ruling coming like this, coming from the Midwest, You know, I think you just felt that sort of echo throughout other Midwestern states where people's lives were really different at that point.
Yeah, it was. The ruling was a surprise. I remember that morning well, hosting this program, sending reverberations across the country. Iowa was being talked about everywhere in the days after that decision. I remember that morning we tossed out the original plans that we had for this program, lined up other guests, and fielded many often emotional, joyful calls from listeners. Jim, your reflections on that day.
Well, I was actually quite surprised at the unanimous decision in the Iowa Supreme Court. I mean, it really reflected a real cultural change, it seems to me, and particularly in Iowa, given its, you know, traditionalism here that and conservatism, frankly. So that was sort of the thing that I was struck by is sort of the magnitude of the change. And then, of course, as you noted, it was not without controversy as the following election year and when the three justices were up for retention and you know they were voted out of office. So it was really quite a stunning move, and particularly sort of as you've already noted, coming from a Midwestern state, which you know you sort of think of the coasts as being probably more liberal and more open on these sorts of things. And Iowa somehow set the standards because in just a few years, and maybe you're going to get into this, of course, the Supreme Court, you know, held in a case by 5-4 that this was really a national kind of cultural change as well.
Yeah, it did. I wanted to get to the question about, you know, what is the climate? It's been 15 years since that decision. What is the climate for LGBTQ Iowans today? The Des Moines Register tackled this in an article of a few days ago with the headline, LGBTQ Iowans say this state is worse off than 15 years ago when same-sex marriage was legalized. To quote from that article just a moment, many Iowans who say it is hard to celebrate the 15th anniversary of the landmark case as anti-LGBTQs Q bills sweep through the Iowa legislature. Even the lead plaintiffs of the case, Trish Varnum and her wife, Kate Varnum, say they have considered leaving the state if they no longer feel safe here. To continue on quoting this article, LGBTQ Iowans who spoke to the Des Moines Register say they are horrified at state lawmakers who have introduced legislation targeting families and youth and threatening their access to health care, instruction, and books in schools, or even their use of preferred pronouns. Comment on this, Megan, about more recent legislation here. I don't know if you'd call it a backlash, but certainly controversial to this day and wider than just same-sex couples, as we note in our acronym LGBTQ.
Yeah, you know, and I think I probably would be somewhat comfortable, you know, talking about this as a backlash. I think, you know, coming, sort of taking a broad view of the of public opinion on lots of different issues, there's really no comparison, I think, for how quickly public opinion and sort of general sense of acceptance and opinion on the LGBTQ community has shifted. It shifted so fast and so rapidly. Because even though we're talking about the 15th anniversary, this is really, I mean, it's big policy changes, big social changes. And what we often see is what we call a thermostatic public opinion, that sort of like the public, when we want a bunch of liberal policies, then we get liberal policies, and then we're like, oh, wait, actually, we want more conservative policies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some political scientists sort of describe this as a more moderate public trying to sort of like get the policy they want out of more extremist elected officials. But there is sort of a general often backlash against large changes in public opinion. But I think it's still, you know, worth noticing when you look at the public opinion, especially when it comes to same-sex marriage, when it comes to, you know, other issues relating to the LGBTQ community, the public is still very supportive of these changes, these more progressive policies. And so it's really this backlash comes in selected areas where, frankly, I think elected officials are somewhat out of step with constituents. And sort of the disconnect is like, why are they still in office if there's this disconnect on this issue?
Right. And just to sort of illustrate the change that has taken place in public attitudes also here in Iowa, I remember soon after that ruling in 2009, talking with Republican lawmakers here in the state who were calling for a referendum to roll back marriage equality in this state. I don't hear those calls now, Megan. I don't think it would pass.
Right. You know, I think there was a small group of maybe two or three Republicans in Iowa in the last legislative session who introduced a bill, I think, to ban same-sex marriage. And there was lots of sort of media coverage of it, but it wasn't a serious effort. Even, you know, other Republicans were sort of like, stop, this is not what we're doing. It was deeply
attitudes
unpopular.
Have changed. Right, exactly. Let's go to our phones before we have to go to break in a couple minutes. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Jackie is with us from Marion. Hi, Jackie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure thing.
I remember, not it may not be exactly this day, but I remember 15 years ago. I was young. I was 9 years old at the time when I saw that Iowa had legalized gay marriage. And I was a very different person back then. I mean, I didn't have as much exposure to LGBTQ as I do now, but I knew in my heart that it was a good thing. And then 6 years later, in 2015, when Hodges v. Obergefell, the Supreme Court decision to federal on the federal level to legalize gay marriage came the day after my 16th birthday, you know? And as a queer trans Iowa woman who is looking to move out of the state, it is disheartening to see where the legislators have taken this state.
Jackie and Marion, thank you very much for your view, at least initially on this program today, remembering 15 years ago, April 3rd, 2009, Iowa became the third state, the very first in the Midwest to establish marriage equality. We're going to get on to some other issues after we finish up with this one. Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University. Megan Goldberg of Cornell College. Still to come, I want to talk about the governor signing the a Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the impact of that possibly in the future. 1-866-780-9100 or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Ben Kiefer back with more of River to River in just a moment.
Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
Back with more of River to River from IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Megan Goldberg with us of Cornell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, our two political scientists as we break down. Later in the program, we'll cover a lot of territory here, the last few days of political developments, both here domestically and abroad. But initially, we're remarking on the day, this day 15 years ago, April 3rd, 2009, Iowa became the third state to establish marriage equality. Welcoming your calls and comments and questions, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. A listener question here that I think has to be on the minds of many those in same-sex relationships out there. This listener says, I always have the possibility of my marriage being nullified, especially in this political climate. What would it look like if the Supreme Court does the same thing to this issue as it did with Dobbs? Megan, there is a I've heard that concern often aired.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is certainly a concern. I think it's unclear exactly sort of how that would work legally, how you nullify those unions. You know, but I think that this is part of, and perhaps a place to learn a lesson, that there's lots of criticism that Congress didn't enshrine abortion access, sort of citing that Roe was the law of the land. And on the flip side, I think what proponents of a policy like this when it comes to same-sex marriage are sort of arguing, was like, we think this is the law of the land too. But as we sort of see this backlash, especially at the state level, you know, it might be worth Congress's consideration, especially with the current court, and sort of the way in which precedents have been struck down, and how those apply to same-sex marriage, to consider, you know, other avenues to protect same-sex marriage.
Yeah. And Jim, really hard to imagine nullifying so many same-sex marriages across the country at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And also, I just would add, you know, the Congress in 2022, of course, changed the Marriage Protection Act. And, you know, they basically allowed gay marriage, you know, had taken that out from the original legislation going back to 1993. I think the other thing, and I just wanted to throw this in, I was looking mm-hmm. for some public opinion data on what the Iowan views are on gay marriage currently, and I was unsuccessful. But what I did find was that Gallup, you know, has some data over time, you know, and the percentage of support for same-sex marriage right at the moment is about 71%. I mean, but this may be segue into, you know, talking about this religious freedom law that was passed, because they also report that there are some partisan divisions on support for gay same-sex marriage, as well as some differences among religious churchgoers and non-religious churchgoers. So that's sort of where it seems to me where the kind of cleavage comes in here in terms of challenge to some of these things. But the idea that the courts could overturn you know, the 2015 decision is pretty tough, because, you know, they've justified the decision under, you know, the 14th Amendment and due process and an equal protection clause. So I think that that's mm-hmm. really very, very unlikely that any case could really make a change at that juncture.
It's an interesting comment left by a caller here. I'll throw out a caller in supportive of marriage equality, but also feels the issue has been handled in a very heavy-handed way in the media, and noted that it takes time for people to accept and evolve, and there's always been a terrible backlash, and some of it has to do with the way it's been handled by the media. Megan, what do you think about that? If we compare what happened in 2009 with what happened, say, in the civil rights movement, the media heavy-handed in pushing this change?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of unclear. I guess it depends on what you mean by the media. But I actually, you know, I think that the media does have an important role to play here. And I'm saying media broadly, not just sort of news media, you know, but there's lots of interesting research on the ways in which sort of like the portrayal in pop culture of couples who are same sex really changes people's acceptance. But I mean, really, the thing that probably moves public opinion the most on sort of an individual micro level is sort of, you know, alluding back to the interviews you mentioned earlier, that these types of decisions make it much easier for people to come out. And when more people come out, more people know someone who's part of a same-sex couple. And it's really hard to sort of, when you know one of those families, to say, actually, I don't think you should be able to be married. And so that's really, you know, probably behind a lot of this shift too, is just it's much more common to know someone who is part of a same-sex marriage, and that changes your opinion because it changes your experiences.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. As Jim mentioned, this dovetails nicely into talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Yesterday evening, it was at a private dinner hosted by the Family Leader. That's a conservative Christian organization. Governor Reynolds signed into law what has been called a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It will allow Iowans to go to court if they believe the government has infringed on their exercise of religion. A quote from Governor Reynolds in a statement, 30 years ago, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed almost unanimously at the federal level, she put out here. Since then, religious rights have been increasingly have increasingly come under attack. Today, Iowa enacts a law to protect these unalienable rights, just as 26 other states have done, upholding the ideals that are the very foundation of our country. Now, the Republicans in our state have worked very hard to pass religious freedom law since taking full control of the Iowa House, the Senate, the governor's office in 2016. Prior versions of this legislation failing to pass. There's opposition, interestingly, here from business groups. Democrats and business groups opposing the law, saying it will allow people to, quote, weaponize their religious beliefs to justify discrimination against LGBTQ Iowans and others by denying them medical care, housing, or other services. Jim, comment on the passage of this law, long sought by especially religious conservatives in our state, and its likely impact.
Well, I think what you commented on it, that it will likely result in several cases, and I think there's already been a statement by someone saying that, you know, they're going to kind of challenge the legality of this particular legislation here. But I do think what it really reflects is the kind of, still underlying all this is kind of the value conflict that exists, within the state of Iowa, but maybe even nationally as well. And I think the legislation calls basically for the courts to engage in what's called strict scrutiny in terms of whether this is a compelling government interest to allow, say, you know, we've had some cases at the Supreme Court where, you know, in terms of baking cakes and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. and holding religious ceremonies for same-sex couples here. I think that what we're going to see really reflected with this law is probably some of these coming to fruition in the state of Iowa here. So I think it really manifests the continuing underlying value conflict, which of course is what politics is about in terms of what values should be propagated and advanced here. So this is, I wouldn't say it's a normal political process, but it's not an unusual political process in some ways.
Yeah, this will be interpreted by the courts, the Iowa Supreme Court, perhaps. The law says that the state and local governments shall not, quote, substantially burden someone's exercise of a religion unless it is a furtherance of a compelling government interest and the least restrictive means of pursuing that interest. Megan, this will be open to court interpretation.
So I think some interesting context here is that this has a federal counterpoint. And as Reynolds sort of talks about, it's from the 90s, and it was actually introduced by Democrats, by Chuck Schumer and Ted Kennedy. It was signed by Clinton. Obviously, a very different sort of political public context at the time. But sort of shortly afterwards, it was ruled that the federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act couldn't be applied to state laws. And so since then, states have been sort of slowly passing these, and Iowa is joining. I think there's 20 or 21 states who have them. But of course, this is the policy that's led to decisions like Hobby Lobby. And it's really sort of tilted, you know, but in the First Amendment, we have both the Free Exercise Clause, but we also have the Establishment Clause. And the court, there's sometimes a tension between those two things. And this act and sort of court interpretations of it have shifted sort of the focus to be on free exercise instead of the Establishment Clause. And so I think that you might see that shift in Iowa as well. Of course, this is only applying to state laws. And so I think in this current political context, with the Republican majority in the House and Republicans controlling the governorship, I'm not sure what state laws this is really going to affect. We'll sort of see how that shakes out. But again, you know, I think the concern that at the state level, this would, I think it's going to be interesting when it bumps up against Iowa's equal protection clause in the Constitution. But I think the implication of what we've seen federally, we're going to see sort of echoes of that at the state level with cases like Hobby Lobby or LGBTQ discrimination.
I thought it was interesting too.
Yeah, Jim, go ahead. Sorry.
Just jump in. I mean, the opposition to this bill came from business groups here, because they're concerned about what it does to, you know, potential employees, I guess, and, you know, recruiting of potential employees. So it's kind of interesting that these business groups, which we would think would some generally be more aligned with Republicans, are in opposition to this particular piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm. Let me get a quick view before our break from the two of you on what happened in Florida. The Florida Supreme Court allowing a strict abortion ban to take effect. The Florida Supreme Court releasing two opinions here on Monday. Could change the landscape of abortion access in that region. Two things here. At the same time, Florida justices triggered a 6-week abortion ban by upholding the state's 15-week restrictions. The court okayed ballot language for a proposed amendment that gives voters in Florida in November the choice of whether to explicitly protect abortion access in that state's constitution. Of course, Florida has a huge number of electoral votes. So what comes to mind for me, Megan, is this sets up abortion as a major election issue in Florida. Do you see further significance for this?
So I think one thing that's happening that's important about Florida right now, too, is that it was sort of one of the last remaining states in the South that sort of had any sort of abortion access. And so that's going to affect not just people in Florida, but it's going to affect people in all sorts of other states. But what that means is if then there's the opportunity for this to go to the public, and sort of what we've seen in other states is that when it goes to the public, you can get a very different result. What you might see is efforts pouring in from all of those other states, from groups in those other states that viewed Florida as important for residents of their own states, for women in Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi, because Florida was a place that they could access abortion that was close-ish. And so I think you could see even more efforts poured into that campaign because of its geographic importance. And that could... If they can replicate what's happened in other states with initiatives, and that sort of echoes into other races on the ballot, I think you could see some interesting results or shakeups in Florida.
I haven't heard that the Democrats have their eyes on winning the electoral votes of Florida, the 30 electoral votes. That's 5 times the number of Iowa's electors. We have 6 in our state. Jim, what do you see as the implications of this Florida ruling?
Well, I think what it means is that the abortion referendum that they're going to have in Florida is going to really be nationalized. And I think already the Democratic National Committee, has targeted that in terms of making that a kind of a central issue. So it's not going to be just a state referendum, it seems to me. It's going to be nationalized in terms of the outcome. I think the other implication of it is, you know, that there's a Senator Scott is up for re-election in the state of Florida. And I wonder what that would, you know, portend in terms of, you know, his chances here. I haven't heard that the Democrats have a particularly strong candidate in opposition to him, but that might make him vulnerable too. So I think it has implications for the national election, but also for the state election and for the senatorial seat here. And again, it shows you that the Democrats are really going to run on this abortion issue, and this is obviously in a very, very large electoral state. That's going to be to their at least political advantage in the near term.
Let me squeeze this in before the break because it relates to this. House Democrats campaign committee targeting vulnerable Republicans who supported a bill that could have threatened access to in vitro fertilization with a new billboard campaign. The Life at Conception Act had more than 160 Republican co-sponsors in the House before the Supreme Court struck that right to an abortion down in 2022. 126 Republicans signed on to the version of the bill introduced in 2023. And quickly, this is a campaign launched to static, digital, mobile billboards calling out Republicans in 8 swing districts for the support of that Life at Conception Act. One of the 8 swing districts targeted, Iowa's first, currently represented by in the U.S. House by Marionette Miller Meeks. Megan, Republicans have largely worked to distance themselves from that Alabama decision that ruled that embryos are children under the law, voiced their support for the in vitro fertilization procedure. How effective do you think this tactic will be by the Democrats in swing districts? We have about a minute before break.
I think it's a competition over who can do a better job messaging. But I think one of the areas, we already know that Marionette Miller-Meeks is perhaps a vulnerable candidate, but one of the other areas for vulnerability here is that there are some conservative, especially faith-based groups who do oppose IVF. And so that's sort of like the Republicans are distancing themselves from Alabama. They have been told to voice their support for IVF, but they also have constituents and interest groups who don't support IVF. And so they've got to walk that line of sort of making both of those cases at the same time.
All right. We'll be back with more of our Politics Wednesday edition of the program. In our last segment, we'll look abroad, but also with the domestic implications for our product, our politics here, talking about the war in Gaza. We'll also talk about that strike in Syria. And also Biden's talks with the Chinese president. If we have time, talk about the U.S. House plan for more aid for Ukraine. Lots to get through with Megan Goldberg and Jim McCormick. It's Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including above and beyond cancer.
So glad you're with us midstream in this edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this Politics Wednesday. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College are two political scientists as we work through as many political developments at home and abroad as we can pack into this hour with their excellent analysis. Let's move on to the war in Gaza. President Biden saying he was outraged by the killing of aid workers in Gaza. We heard about that. Israeli strikes killed 7 World Central Kitchen workers on Monday, including a U.S.-Canadian dual citizen, drawing really international condemnation. This team of aid workers had cleared its movements with the Israeli military when 3 of its vehicles were struck. Israel's prime minister expressing regret for the incident, saying it's under investigation. Also, let me throw this in before I hand it over to Jim for his reflections on it. An Israeli strike in Syria killing a senior Iranian commander and some other top leaders, a major escalation in Israel's war on Iran-supported Hamas. Before we go to any callers on this, Jim, what do you think about these latest developments?
Well, I think it's really a difficult situation that Israel finds itself in yet again. I mean, the reaction as, you know, President Biden saying the killings of these aid workers were disgusting. And I noticed that Australian Prime Minister said that he was angry and concerned because one of the people killed was an Australian. I heard this morning on BBC that, you know, British officials called for, the United States to stop providing military assistance to Israel over this. And so, you know, this is further getting, it seems to me, Israel into a corner here in terms of their action. I mean, I think it's laudable that Netanyahu said he's going to call for an immediate investigation and to make the finding public here. But the immediate reaction was that also a ship turned back that was going to Gaza, you know, went back to Syria here. So the situation in Gaza is even more going back to Cyprus. Did I say Syria? Excuse me. Going back to Cyprus. And so they're even in a more serious kind of situation here. I wasn't clear as to why the Israelis, I mean, they've been reported that they attacked in Damascus, to this consulate in Damascus, and the killing of the Revolutionary Guard commander here. I wasn't sure of the timing of this, except to sort of escalate things, perhaps take attention away a little bit from the Gaza situation. But it I think it's a very, very difficult situation, and it puts further sort of pressure on the Biden administration as to really what, you know, what options are available here. I mean, they did in the recent vote in the UN Security Council, of course, abstain, and the ceasefire resolution was passed, although the United States has said that this was done under Chapter 6 of the UN Charter, which does not mean an automatic enforcement immediately, rather than Chapter 7. So again, the Biden administration here has, it finds itself in a very difficult situation in terms of addressing the relationship with Israel. Now, you know, and maybe Megan will weigh in on this, the implications back home, you know, there's already been opposition growing to American support for Israel, you know, among Palestinian, pro-Palestinian groups here. So this is a really a great challenge, it seems to me, for the administration at this juncture.
Yeah, and interestingly, Megan, before you share your thoughts, Donald Trump said in a recent interview that Israel was losing public support for its Gaza assault with the images of the devastation, that they were bad for Israel's global image, and that the Prime Minister Netanyahu should end the war soon. Megan, your thoughts here.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's as Jim has said, there's been sort of shifting public opinion, and this is sort of just like another... You know, there are lots of folks who are already sort of ready for advocating for ceasefires, who are extremely frustrated and concerned about Israel. But this is sort of just another for folks who are sort of on that line, who are part of that shift. It's another sort of strike against Israel in terms of public opinion. I mean, it's deeply unpopular when aid members of aid groups die. I think especially in particular, you know, World Kitchen is a popular one, somewhat well known. And it's, you know, there's debate over the intentionality of it, of course. That's probably most people aren't paying attention to, but it's another sort of thing that's, I think, going to further shift that opinion. And it's going to keep putting, as we've talked about before, it put Biden in a position where he has to deal domestically with this situation. He has to respond, I think, to public opinion, and, you know, balance foreign policy interests at the same time.
Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, our two political scientists on board in the final 10 minutes or so of this program. Let's go to Mike in Moline. Thanks for waiting, Mike. We're running out of time a bit. We want to get to a couple of other things, but I know you wanted to mention something here. Welcome.
Hello. Yes, I had to mention about the aid workers being killed. And you had a caller last week that mentioned in the 67 war when Israel attacked a U.S. Navy ship for hours, I believe it was 3 or 4 hours, and killed 30 American sailors. It seems like Israel is not called out on this, and if they are, they talk about anti-Semitism, and you get to hear about the Holocaust again. It's not the first time Israel has committed a war crime. I'd like to hear a comment from your guests.
Mike in Moline, Jim, would you like to tackle that? I'm sure on the history that he mentioned, also from last week.
Yeah, I'd have to think about the 1957 attack. I'm not quite sure whether he's talking about during the Suez War or what. But any event, you know, the International Court of Justice, you know, had held a hearing back in January, you know, and after the South Africa, you know, filed a petition, you know, to see whether there was, you know, genocide going on with regard to the actions in Gaza. And I mean, they didn't say that there was genocide going on, but they did say to, you know, that there has to be, you know, a careful assessment of actions that are being carried forth. So I think it's more, I think probably the best response to the caller is to say, you know, the administration, American administration, really has to continue to, it seems, to put pressure on Netanyahu. I mean, he's in a difficult situation given his war cabinet and his support, you know, to move towards cease fire, or at least to open up the channels in terms of getting humanitarian aid. Some of the descriptions of the inspections and the slowness of the inspections of the trucks that are going into Gaza that I have been witnessing makes it very difficult to get food aid properly. Although the United Nations Relief Agency did say that they have had some success very recently. But I think that would be sort of the starting point in terms of putting pressure on the Israelis to make certain that the relief trucks that are, at Rafah and so on, can make more rapid progress within Gaza itself.
Okay. Let's go back to our phones. Conroy in Des Moines, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Bo. Yeah, my sister went to
one. Hello? Hello, Conroy. Yeah, you're finally on, sir.
Yeah, I want to comment about the Gaza war.
Yes, make your point. We're coming up to the end of our program, sir. Go ahead.
I think Biden should do more. He's just talking. They need to stop it right now.
Okay.
Too many innocent people getting killed. And Israel is making too many excuses. I understand what 250 people got kidnapped, 150 maybe got released, 200 people died, or 1,200 people died, but that doesn't justify killing 33,000 people, mainly women and kids. They need to stop it right now.
Conroy in Des Moines, thank you for your view. Let's move on to a couple of other items abroad here. Yesterday, President Biden, Chinese President Xi Jinping holding a telephone call to discuss a variety of economic, military, political issues related to the U.S.-China bilateral relationship. Jim, you're our foreign policy guy. The first time Biden and Xi have spoken one-on-one since their meeting, we remember, in the Bay Area. That was the APEC summit last November. Comes ahead of two major trips to China by Biden administration officials, Treasury Secretary Yellen and Secretary of State Blinken. The significance of this call and what you see in the reports?
I think the significance of it, first of all, is just to keep the communication channels open, as the administration said. But also, I think to put the Chinese on notice, for example, in terms of some of their recent actions with regard to Taiwan. The president asked for some help with regard to the Houthis with Iran in the attacks in the Red Sea area, and also to move away from their support really for Russia here. Whether that will land on deaf ears, I mean, I guess is really the problem. But I think the significance of it from the American point of view is to make certain that the United States has not turned its attention away from the concerns with regard to the Chinese actions, even as they're sort of bogged down with Ukraine and with the Middle East. So hopefully that will at least temporize the relationship a little bit in the short term. I guess I'm not totally optimistic that there would be much of a Chinese response to some of these requests that the president is making here.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on, Megan. I'll toss this into your court here about this perhaps more aid for Ukraine, the plan that Republican Speaker of the House Mike Johnson has put forward for getting the new military assistance approved by Congress and for holding on to power, I guess. The Louisiana congressman told Fox News he would push the House to structure new Ukraine support in the form of loans. And to cover the costs, he suggested authorizing the U.S. government to seize and sell Russian assets that have been frozen since the start of the Ukraine war. This is a large sum. $300 billion of Russian central bank assets have been frozen, most of those under European, not American control, we should note there. An additional sweetener the speaker put in for his Republican colleagues, proposing to tie the passage of the Ukraine aid to legislation ending a hold on new liquefied natural gas export authorizations. Megan, your thoughts on the speaker's attempt here. Can he do both, get more aid to Ukraine and hold on to his speakership?
I think that's a million-dollar question. You know, I think that he's been sort of under threat this entire time. But really, the power that Johnson has is who else? Who else is it going to be? They can remove him. But at some point, you need another speaker. And I think we saw in this last round that that was not an easy task. You know, on the other hand, I think that he has a challenge that we have seen the sort of, I don't want to say old guard of the Republican Party, but the more moderate Republicans have also gotten quite frustrated. You know, I think Wisconsin member Representative Mike Gallagher is leaving the House,
yes,
I think, early on April 19th. And so I think that's another sign that this sort of deal is going to be extremely challenging, and that it is not getting easier to unite the Republicans in the House. It's getting more difficult. And I don't necessarily think Johnson has the experience and the expertise to navigate these situations.
Yeah. And Marjorie Taylor Greene making that motion to vacate the speaker, speaker's seat. And then the speculation here that, well, should there be another battle for another speaker, if Johnson is deposed here, if that's the right word, we could have a Democrat. Hakeem Jeffries could be the speaker. Jim, your thoughts here on what's happening in the House and how this aid for Ukraine may or may not be pushed through.
Well, one significant thing, it seems to me, is that apparently Johnson has dropped any statement about border policy being incorporated into this bill. I thought that was a significant kind of compromise, and of course that's very fact is also endangers him in terms of getting an aid package through. But he's personally committed to getting aid to Ukraine, so I think that he'll barrel ahead, and rely upon Democratic votes to get this done. He's probably going to lose some of the Freedom House, Freedom Caucus people, in terms of this package that he's putting together. But he gets some buyout in terms of not expending extra money because they're going to use these frozen, I think, $5 trillion. Yeah, I hope I got my trillions and billions right. $5 billion, right?
Yeah. $300 billion, yeah. I think, Jim. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's getting some. That was one of the other demands that the Freedom Caucus was making, that there would not, that the further aid to Ukraine would not be taken out of, for more budget spending by the United States. And the other part of this, of course, is that they would be using Russian money against Russia by providing aid to Ukraine. So there is some talking points that he has with his more recalcitrant members to get this passed.
Jim McCormick, Megan Goldberg, we have run out of time. Thank you, and thanks to our listeners for their input this hour. Another Politics Wednesday has come to an end. Jim McCormick, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Ben.
Megan Goldberg, Assistant Professor of American Politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon, thank you so much, Megan.
Thanks, Ben.
Tomorrow on this program, we'll travel back to 1869 when Iowa experienced a total solar eclipse. The path of that eclipse in 1869 from Sioux City to Keokuk, my guest, a research astronomer from the University of Northern Iowa. His new book is titled America's First Eclipse Chasers. That's tomorrow on the program. Today's program produced by Catherine Perkins with help from Samantha McIntosh, Maddie Willis, technical support from Sean McClain. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.